Battleground State Report with Michael Patrick Leahy and Doug Kellen.
And welcome back to the Battleground State Report. Michael Patrick Leahy here. Doug Kellett off this week, but he will be back next. Welcome, everybody. What an interesting week we've had in politics. So far, Jimmy, the president has or has not been impeached.
It's one or the other.
He either has or hasn't.
Yep.
You know, we talked about it on our other program. It's sort of like that old saying, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, did it really fall? Did it really make a noise?
If a tree falls in the forest, did Nancy Pelosi really cut it down?
Well, that's where we're at. So this is, it's a fascinating kind of chess game going on. And what you have here is Nancy Pelosi on December 18th, the partisan vote in the House of Representatives, it's like, you know, 230 to 197. And there were only two Democrats who voted no. One of those Democrats, Jeff Van Drew, immediately became a Republican. And one of them, Colin Peterson, is in a district in western Minnesota that where he, you know, President Trump won that district by 30 points. So I guess Nancy Pelosi gave him a pass. There's a third Democrat who voted yes on one of the articles of impeachment and no on the other. So he voted yes on abuse of power, I think, and no on obstruction of Congress. That's Jared Polquin, I think is the guy's name, from Maine. So this happened on December 18th. Tick-tock goes the clock. It's been, 10-plus days in January, and they're 12. So it's been over 3 weeks. And typically, when the House of Representatives, Jimmy, when the House of Representatives passes a law, typically that law is formally transmitted from, this is a very administrative function. It's, they have the clerk, they have an assistant to the clerk takes the bound document from the House and it physically is transmitted to the Senate. Guess what? This is all unusual. Apparently the report is, so Nancy Pelosi has not formally transmitted the articles of impeachment to the Senate. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has a response to that. And I think he could say one of two things. He could have said, well, whether or not you transmit these articles, the president has been impeached and we will commence a trial. Now, the Constitution is very clear on the division of responsibilities on impeachment matters between the House of Representatives, the lower chamber of our legislative branch, and the United States Senate, the upper chamber. And of course, the House of Representatives has 435 members. Members are allocated proportionately by the population of the state. And then the Senate, each of the 50 states have two senators. So there's 100 members of the Senate. It's, the more deliberative body. But the Constitution is very clear. Impeachment takes place in the House. But the Constitution also says the sole power to impeach, to hold a trial on impeachment, the sole power to hold a trial on whether to convict and remove any federal official, be it the president or a federal judge, it lies with the United States Senate. Notice, Jimmy, it says the power to hold a trial. It does not say that a trial must be held. By tradition, a trial has been held. That's how the Senate, according to its rules, has handled that. Now, so I think Mitch McConnell could have said, well, whether or not Speaker Pelosi, Democrat-controlled House, Republican-controlled Senate, whether or not you decide to formally transmit the paper that says the president has been impeached with the articles of impeachment. He has, in fact, been impeached. And Mitch McConnell could have said, we will therefore go ahead and begin the trial. No, he didn't choose that. He could have done that.
Mm-hmm.
He took, I think, a very reasoned approach and said, we will commence a trial the moment the speaker transmits those articles. Well, the speaker hasn't done that and may or may not do it, by the way.
Now, is she trying to delay the trial? I mean, that's what it sounds like.
You know, she's just trying to... We don't really know what she's trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
Other than to... I think she's trying to leverage her transmission to force the Senate to conduct a trial the way she wants it. Mm-hmm. And that trial would be including a list of witnesses that could... You know, potentially say something that could potentially be said to be, you know, a smoking gun, right?
Okay.
Here's the problem with that. The Constitution gives no role in the trial to the House. There's nothing she can do. And Republicans control the Senate. Now, here's the very clever thing that has happened in the Senate. And Mitch McConnell has said, I'm in favor of this. My guess is... He may have instigated it, but we'll see. So the freshman senator from Missouri, Josh Hawley, has introduced a resolution which says the following, to change the Senate rules so that if the House impeaches anyone, including the president, and fails to transmit the articles of impeachment within 25 days, the Senate will be required to automatically dismiss those charges.
Hmm.
Tick-tock goes a clock. That's January 12th. That resolution on this Monday is likely to be passed by the Senate. So that would then, you know, that would actually, that would be this Monday. And so the following Tuesday, if that the articles haven't been transmitted, automatically they would be dismissed. We'll talk about that more when we get back. This is a Battleground State Report. I'm Michael Patrick Leahy, back after this.
You're listening to the Battleground State Report.
And welcome back to the Battleground State Report. Michael Patrick Leahy here, Doug Kellett off for the week. He'll be back next week. We're talking about the impeachment debacle going on. And, you know, I hesitate to make any predictions about this. I know...
What? You?
People.
Why would you hesitate?
Well, I have to have some evidence. And
details.
You know, who knows how this will play out?
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, our listeners want to know. You know, they want to know what I think about it this week, what will happen this week. By the way, one of the things to do is if you want to really have a good idea of day-to-day, there's a go to TennesseeStar.com, and you can see there we've got a little link to the impeachment, War Room Impeachment, which is a daily podcast that our friend Steve Bannon and Jason Miller and Raheem Kassam have been conducting since the impeachment proceedings began. And I think they're like day, I don't know. Day, what is it? Day 87, something like that? Yeah, keeps going on and on. They do every morning at 9 o'clock Eastern time, 8 o'clock Central time, they have a one-hour, you know, what's the latest and greatest. And they are going to continue with that broadcast and that podcast until the president, as Steve Bannon says, the president is acquitted in the trial in the Senate. That could happen this week, I think, depending on how things play out. You know, the Democrats, the way they're approaching this, you know, it seems to me, Jimmy, that the Democrats are really, they're losing steam because the positions that they're taking are so far, far, far from the general population. And so, case in point. So, look at how they've interacted with... the media, and to describe this response to our taking out this very, very bad Iranian general. Now, he's called a general. It's about Soleimani. I always get these names mixed up, but he's gone, by the way. So last week, the president took him out, or the American military took him out. Have you seen the details of how they took him out?
No.
Pretty impressive. Let me just say, if you're an enemy of the United States, the way he was taken out would inspire fear in anybody else out there thinking of going after America. So apparently, so the background is there was an Iranian militia, Iraqi militia of hoodlums, shall we say, who tried to storm the American embassy in Baghdad, the capital of Iraq. And they, what they were trying to do is they were trying to recreate the Benghazi situation where, you know, the bad guys killed four Americans, including the American ambassador. And the Obama administration, Secretary of State Clinton, did nothing to defend them, left them there to die, literally left them there to die. Well, President Trump is not that kind of president. And so obviously he immediately got 100 Marines in there. They defended the embassy. It began to disperse. Well, this was all apparently instigated by this Soleimani guy from Iran. And so he decided, apparently, he wanted to come in and personally direct an attempt to, according to the president, burn down the American embassy if they couldn't capture it. So he got in a plane from Tehran and flew into the Baghdad airport. Now, we apparently can track bad guys, Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
And we have drones. And so what happened, here's like the logistics of it. We were tracking him so closely. We had our drones ready to take him out with, you know, military. I guess it would be sort of like, a missile, short-range missile that took him out. So his plane lands in the Baghdad airport. And literally, he walks off his plane, gets into an SUV, and that's like 30 seconds after he's off the plane. As he gets into the SUV with one of his aides, whoosh, he's gone. A missile from a drone blows that SUV to smithereens.
So I'm guessing it took out anybody that was in that SUV as well.
You would not want to have been in that SUV. Because if you were in that SUV, there's nothing left of you.
Yeah.
Okay. So what they apparently had, what he ended up with is like they were identified. There was a hand that they found with a ring on it. And they were identified DNA, whatever. They identified with that. And there were just like smoldering little parts of debris and whatever, remnants, human remnants. They put those remnants in three cardboard boxes, okay? And it was those cardboard boxes passenger seats in an airplane that went back from Baghdad to Tehran. Then when those remains get to Tehran, and this is fascinating, what they did is they put those three cardboard boxes, apparently, on the roof of a Chevrolet SUV, American-made.
Mm-hmm.
So the guy's blown up by an American-made missile, launched by an American-made drone, flown back in an American-made plane. And then his funeral procession was on the top of an American-made car. Hmm. So they had, you know, these big processions, big protests there. And they're so out of control. There were stampedes. 50 people died over there. Okay, so then what happens? So this all happens, and all of the Democrats, Nancy Pelosi, are, you know, the president just took out this martyr. They're saying this. Now, meanwhile, this guy lives. The American embassy is likely blown up. Or, you know, attempted to blown up. And so they're defending this guy. They're turning this enemy of America into a martyr. Okay, so next step. So that doesn't help them with the American public. The American public, as Rush Limbaugh said this past week, all the polls show, the American public is center-right, and the American public is patriotic. The Democrats, of course, are not center-right, and they certainly aren't patriotic in this. So then the story continues. Iran, later that week, later last week, decides, well, we've got to show, we've got to, you know, save face and try to do some kind of an attempted counterattack on America. Okay. So they've got these short-range interballistic missiles, and they launch them from Iran, and they aim them at American military bases in Iraq. Okay. But I guess they have bad aim. They don't cause any significant damage. They don't kill any Americans. Now, a lot of people have been reporting that that was intentional. Intentional because they had to do it to save face with a domestic Iranian audience,
mm-hmm.
right? But they didn't want to incur the wrath of Donald Trump again. That's a report. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if it's true or not. And then immediately they issue a tweet that says, you know, we've taken the appropriate counter action. In other words, it's sort of like, don't hit us again, Mr. President. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah.
But the rest of the story, this is a sad part of it. At the same time as these missiles are going from Iran to Iraq, there's a plane filled with 178 folks, 68 of which are Canadian. And they're leaving, the plane's leaving Tehran for the Ukraine, the Ukrainian plane. Mysteriously crashes. All on board die.
Mm.
Now, Western sources are saying was hit by an errant missile that was intended to go and hit the U.S. bases in Iraq. That's what the sources, Iran's denying it. But I don't know, who are you going to believe, Jimmy? Western sources or the Iranian government?
Yeah.
I think I know who I'm going to believe. Mm-hmm. Hey, more with the Battleground State Report when we get back. I'm Michael Patrick Leahy. Back after this.
State Report with Michael Patrick Leahy and Doug Kellett.
And welcome back to the Battleground State Report. I'm Michael Patrick Leahy. And Jimmy, the other big story here is, and I'll talk about it in two issues. The other big story is the rise of grassroots conservative populism around the country. And pushing back against, shall we say, the administrative edicts of state government, governors in the state government. And there's two. I'll mention the first one. I won't really get into detail on that in this segment. I'll talk more about the second one. The first one is, you know, it started off in the state of Virginia, where the governor there, Governor Northam, you know, the guy who was, you know, was in blackface and claimed he was and doesn't remember it, but
pretty much
it was him. The same guy that just said, you know, with regards to abortion, well, we may have live birth, but if we don't want to keep the baby, we'll have a discussion about whether or not to keep him after they're born, right? And then after that discussion, we might do something. We might terminate them after they're born.
Mm.
That guy, real nice guy.
Yeah.
He apparently has threatened to go in and confiscate the guns of certain kinds of guns from Virginians. Not very popular with most counties in Virginia. And so now we've had what's called the Second Amendment Sanctuary County resolutions going on. And I think the vast majority of Virginia counties have signed on to that. So there's a little bit of Second Amendment anti-big government rebellion going on in the state of Virginia, and it's spreading through counties all around the country. Now, there's another issue here having to do with the refugee resettlement program, and it's here in Tennessee, of course, where the governor, Bill Lee, has made a very bad decision to say, welcome refugees. He's not the only Republican governor to do that, and we'll talk about that here in a second. So just the setting in the background is the refugees have been allowed to come into the United States since 1980. It's when the Refugee Act of 1980 was passed by the Congress and signed into law by Jimmy Carter. And what that says is basically there's a process for handling refugees. And the first part of the process overseas is handled by the United Nations, where they put together a process where they vet refugees who want to, are looking to leave their war-torn countries or looking to leave their countries, period. And by the way, the country, guess which country in the world takes, you know, the vast majority of refugees?
United States.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
That's been historically the case. Now, so they have a security vetting of some level and then a medical vetting. And again, not that strong. I've documented that a lot in some of the writings that I've done at Breitbart. But I'm just describing the process, not necessarily the quality of the vetting, which has improved slightly on the security side under President Trump, but really not improved at all under the medical side. Anyway, so the way this law works, Jimmy, is this. The president, every fiscal year, the president sets a cap as to the amount of refugees who will be resettled in the United States under this process. That is, they're sort of vetted through this UN process. They get the green light, and then the Department of State, through the Bureau of Population and Refugees and Migrants, decides what states they're going to be settled in. And then once they're here, they're paid by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is out of the Housing and Health and Human Services Department. So the president, when he ran for president, Barack Obama was bringing refugees in from hotbeds of terrorism, Iraq and Yemen and Iran and Somalia, Sudan. And they were having problems. They weren't assimilating because the bureaucracy that handles this had said, we're not going to assimilate anymore. That's been their policy for almost 20 years since Bill Clinton. And it caused problems in communities where they settled. A big time problem for the Somali community in Minneapolis, the largest Somali community in America, about 100,000 people. Spikes in crime, all sorts of difficulties there. Also a big Somali community in Columbus, Ohio. Again, spikes in crime, not assimilating. It's a big issue. This was an issue that drove President Trump's electoral victory in 2016, and particularly in states where they had put in lots of refugees from these hotbeds of terrorism under the Obama administration. Every year under the law, the president sets a cap, a top number, the maximum number of refugees you can bring into the United States. And then the bureaucrats in the State Department say where and which states they'll go. Well, under President Obama in his last year, they were bringing in 90,000 refugees, and they wanted to bring in more. Hillary Clinton, if she'd been elected, wanted to bring 200,000 refugees in her first year and wanted to have like 75,000 of them come from Syria. You know, not exactly a hotbed of terrorism. Oh, yeah, a hotbed of terrorism. So President Trump on the campaign trail said, look, I'm going to improve vetting for refugees, number one. Number two, I'm going to dramatically decrease the number of refugees. Number three, I'm going to decrease the number of refugees that come from hotbeds of terrorism. And number four, I'm going to pass an executive order that says no refugees can be settled in a state or locality without the approval of the state government and the local government. That's actually, Jimmy, part of the Refugee Act of 1980. It's a part of the act, though, that the deep state bureaucrats who have close relationships with the voluntary agencies that get paid a lot of money to resettle these refugees, they weren't really enforcing it. So it required an executive order to basically say, look, which the president did in September, signed an executive order. No refugees will be settled in a state unless the governor says, yes, we want more refugees. And in a county within a state, unless the county says, yes, we want more refugees. Well, here in Tennessee, Governor Bill Lee, ignoring the fact that the Tennessee General Assembly 3 years ago passed a resolution to sue the federal government on 10th Amendment grounds to not allow them to resettle refugees in the state because these were costs being borne by the state after a few months of refugees being paid for by the federal government. Here they are in the state, and they're eligible for social welfare and education benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And taxpayers in Tennessee were paying for that. So Governor Lee, without consulting the Tennessee General Assembly, Governor Lee decides to say, well, yes, although he could have said no, he said, and zero refugees would have come into Tennessee for this fiscal year. He sends a letter to the president and says, oh, bring them on in. I really want them. Well, it's lots of pushback, very unpopular. Counties in the state are pushing back. Loudoun County had a resolution saying no. Others, Wilson County, Madison County, many counties are in the process of pushing back. What's interesting about this now, Jimmy, is you know, Bill Lee is not alone among kind of what's the right word, the rhino squish governors who are just, you know, caving to the left on it. In fact, Governor Mike DeWine of Ohio, not exactly a conservative, has said, bring on the refugees. Yeah, we want more. The president, by the way, this year has taken that cap on refugees from the entire country, which was 90,000 in the last year of the Obama administration. This fiscal year, it's down to 18,000. Okay, but you know they can be sent to any state that says yes, and the number that come into the state, the state can't determine.
So I guess the president can't say zero.
The president could say zero.
Really?
Yeah, he could say zero.
Then why would he say 18? I mean, I know that's a drastic, you know, decrease, but still.
Well, that's a really good question. I think there are a lot of factors that go into it. I think what he's trying to do, I think he's gone down steadily every year. He could go down to zero next year, and he might. We'll see.
Kind of weaning him off a little at a time?
A little bit of that. Yeah. A little bit of that. Anyway, so the Republican governors have tried to kind of, and Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas has done this, and Mike DeWine has. Who hasn't done it are the conservative governors, Greg Abbott of Texas and Ron DeSantis of Florida. We'll explain this more when we get back. You're listening to the Battleground State Report. I'm Michael Patrick Leahy.
This is the Battleground State Report.
This is Michael Patrick Leahy with the Battleground State Report. It's a great Saturday morning here in the state of Tennessee, and we're starting to go out into other states as well with this program. We've got we've got some programming changes that are coming up in terms of our co-hosts.
Uh-huh.
In addition to Doug, we'll be announcing that, you know, because the Battleground State Report is. We record this here in Tennessee, and we're broadcast in Tennessee, but we're about to go out in some real battleground states.
Really?
Yeah, be picked up in Ohio and Michigan, and
that's pretty exciting.
And we have a battleground stater who will be joining us as a co-host, and it's a pretty significant person.
You're actually teasing us now, right?
That's what I'm doing.
Okay, good job.
Because the verbal agreement with this co-host from a battleground state has been made.
Mm-hmm.
But the I's haven't been dotted and the T's haven't been crossed.
You're waiting for the ink.
Waiting for the ink to dry.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to be very exciting because we'll, you know, we've been doing this Battleground State Report for about a year and a half now. And we've largely been, you know, carried in Tennessee. But now we've got some interest in Ohio and Michigan and Minnesota, you know, where we've got the Ohio Star and the Minnesota Sun from our vast news empire.
Mm-hmm.
that owns the Tennessee
Star. Continues to grow.
And so this past week, I was up actually in Columbus, Ohio to talk to him, work that deal out. And It's really very exciting. So, but see, the reason that's interesting is because we're talking about this refugee issue. This is an issue. This is a big issue in all of the battleground states. All the states, Minnesota, right? And so in Minnesota, Michigan, Ohio, big deal. In Minnesota, the Democratic governor, Tim Walz, has said, yeah, we want more refugees. Now, Minnesota has huge problems with refugees. The tuberculosis rate there has skyrocketed in Minnesota. Foreign-born sources of tuberculosis have increased significantly in the past 20 years. It was like 30% of all cases about 20 years ago. Now it's up to 70%. In Minnesota, it's 90%. Most of the cases of tuberculosis in Minnesota have come from refugees, actually, foreign-born refugees. And there's even crime problems there, et cetera. So what happened in Minnesota is a county in the north part of the state this past week passed this resolution saying, you know, we do not want to have any refugees in this county. As, of course, under the president's executive order. So the president, by the way, signed this executive order in September that said, you know, refugees can't be settled if the governor and the state government and local government say no. And Beltrami County exercised that option this past week. And the state rep there, Matt Grosso, is a Republican, said, quote, President Trump empowered counties to have a voice in the decision-making process for the federal refugee resettlement program. Tonight, Beltrami County, Minnesota, exercised that option. Of course, part of the problem up there is, you know, since the large number of Somali refugees have come into Minnesota, crime has spiked and all sorts of problems associated with that community up there. So that's, you know, what's happening in Minnesota. Similar in Michigan, a Democratic governor said, yeah, come on in. In Ohio, a Republican governor, kind of a moderate squish, shall we say, like Bill Lee here in Tennessee, Republican governor Mike DeWine has said, yeah, come on in. We want more refugees. And so it's a problem there as well. It's a problem everywhere. And so these Republican governors, these moderate governors, have sort of tried to figure out, well, how can we push back politically against this? And they've got a little strategy here. I'm going to read to you my good friend John Binder, who writes on refugees issues at Breitbart. I've written extensively on all these issues at Breitbart from 2013 to 2017 and 2018. And this past year, actually, I've shifted my lane at Breitbart into Red for Red and the politicization and of teachers unions to be pro-Democrat, anti-Republican. But John Binder has just done a wonderful job. I just want to read this story up at Breitbart this week. Facing backlash, Republican governors are pitching refugee resettlement to its opponents as close cooperation between state officials and refugee contractors who are tasked with resettling refugees. And in Arkansas, for instance, here's what John Binder writes. A total of 18 Republican governors have signed off on plans to resettle more refugees in their states and have given various recent interviews to defend their decision against opposition from residents and local communities. Behind the scenes, an internal memo to state legislators in Arkansas from Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, a Republican, one of those 18 Republican governors, reveals how refugee resettlement is being pitched to its opponents mostly as close cooperation between the state and refugee contractors, though the federal government gives nearly exclusive control of the issue to the State Department and the contractors they fund with American taxpayer money. This is the point. This is the entire point. These Republican governors are justifying their decision based upon something that is factually untrue, right? They're saying it's cooperation between the state government and refugee contractors, when really the entire program is it's the federal government. They give exclusive control on the issue to the State Department and the contractors like Catholic Charities and various folks that are being given American taxpayer money to do that. And this is what Governor Asa Hutchinson, this is how he explained it. He told legislators in Arkansas, Why did the governor send the letter to Secretary Pompeo? Under President Donald Trump's Executive Order 13888, refugee resettlement in a state or community is not permitted without the approval of the governor. Also, it should say without approval of the governor and the local county. He forgot to mention that. The letter was in response to the executive order's direction and based upon the improved security checks in place. Now, there are reports that there are an improvement in security checks. More, it's, you know, interagency cooperation. That doesn't mean that they're catching everything, but there have been improvements. The approval is for 1 year, 2020, and is limited to those communities who have indicated indicated they are willing to receive refugees and have support of. Now, their resettlement agency is called Canopy. Here in Tennessee, it's called the Catholic Charities, the Tennessee Office of Refugees being a division of Catholic Charities. They only have one approved refugee resettlement organization in Arkansas called Canopy. That Canopy is probably part of one of these larger groups. I don't think it's Catholic Charities, but it's like Lutheran Immigration Service, something like that. They can say, in what areas of the state are they authorized to resettle refugees? They've resettled most of their refugees in Fayetteville and Springdale. However, they have on limited occasion resettled some families in Rogers, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Clarksville. From what countries have refugees been resettled this year? In Arkansas, it was the Democratic Republic of Congo, Liberia, Rwanda, Iran. Oh, wonderful! Iraq and Afghanistan. God, love having those Iranian refugees in Arkansas, don't you? Basically, what do we know from which countries these refugees will be resettled under the letter that the governor of Arkansas signed and other governors, including Governor Bill Lee and Mike DeWine and Bill Lee in Tennessee, Mike DeWine in Ohio? Under the executive order, the authorization from the governor of a state is not allowed to limit the countries of origin for the refugees. Oh, tell that to Governor Bill Lee in Tennessee. He missed that memo. Based upon experience and informal communication, it is expected that the countries such as the following may be sent to Arkansas, African nations, and those nations in which the United States has engaged in military actions and cooperating nationals are at risk. How do you know it's like that we're engaged in military operations? How do you know you're bringing over people who are at risk? How do you know that these people aren't posing a risk?
Mm-hmm.
That's my question. And the governor closes out, you know, well, what are they eligible for? What social services do taxpayers have to pay for? Refugees, Governor Hutchinson says, are eligible for 36 months of case management assistance and financial assistance when they first arrive through a combination of federal and private funds. They do not receive any other special financial assistance aside from, wait for this, here's where the state obligation comes in. Typical public assistance available to other low-income Arkansans, Medicaid, SNAP, TANF, etc. How about that? How about that? There's the taxpayers of Arkansas on the hook to pay for these refugees that they don't want. And here, taxpayers in Tennessee on the hook to pay for all these social services to refugees that don't want to assimilate are offered. And it's the same in Ohio and really across the country. So this is going to be a really interesting issue to see how it plays out. This has animated people at the grassroots level, the county level, because they want the county commissions to say, county mayors, county executives to say, Governor, take your refugees and put them not here.
I think there's one word that can describe why we don't need more refugees.
What's that?
Omar.
Omar, Ilhan Omar, yes, the poster child of what a refugee might do or think when they come here to the United States. You know, Ilhan Omar was a refugee from Somalia who came here. By the way, if you look into it, there are reports that she's really not the person she says she is. She came in under, she's not. The whole thing about how she came here.
She really didn't marry her brother? Is that what you're saying?
No, the evidence that she did to violate immigration laws. It's, that's the claim, and you know, everybody's silent about that. So you know, if you're a Somalia refugee, you know, because you're a refugee from Somalia, you're apparently morally superior to and deserve more than American citizens do. I don't know. That's not playing so well here.
No.
Not playing so well in Tennessee, not playing so well in Arkansas, not playing so well in Ohio, not playing so well in Minnesota. You're going to see that issue continue to come home. And in those states where the Republican governors have said, bring on some more refugees and let's have the Tennessee and our state taxpayers pay for them, you're seeing, as you are seeing here in Tennessee, but in other legislatures as well, I think you probably see it in Arkansas and Minnesota and all those sorts of places. You see that the legislators about probably going to pass laws saying, nope, we don't want them, and are likely to override the governor's veto. We'll have more on this next week. Battleground State Report. I'm Michael Patrick Leahy. We will be joined again next week by Doug Kellett and possibly a new host, co-host.
Wow. Possibly. That soon, huh? Okay,
possibly good. From one of these battleground states who's actually going to give details on the battlegrounds the battleground. I'm Michael Patrick Leahy. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week at this same time.